Afterlife. Control, at the heart of a different tragedy, could see nothing but Rachel McCarthy with a bullet in her head falling endlessly into the quarry. The sense of nothing being real during that time, that the room they had put him in and the investigator assigned to him were both constructs. And if he just kept holding on to that thought, eventually the investigator would dissolve into nothing, and the walls of his cell would fall away, and he would walk out into a world that was real. Then, and only then, would he wake up to continue with his life, which would follow the path it had followed to that point. Even though the chair for the long hours of questioning cut into the back of his thigh and left a mark, even though he smelled the bitter cigarette smoke on the investigator's jacket and heard the hiccuping whirr of the tape in the recorder the man had brought in as a backup for the room's video recording, even though the texture of the wall felt like a manta ray from the aquarium, firm and smooth, with a serrated roughness but with more give, and behind it the sense of something vast breathing in and out. A rupture into the world of the rotted honey smell, fading fast but hard to forget, like the swirling flourish of a line of balsamic on a chef's plate, the line of dark blood leading to a corpse on a cop show. His parents had read Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright to him as a child. They had collaborated on a social studies project with him, his mother on research and his father on cut and paste. They had taught him how to ride a bike. The pathetic little Christmas tree next to the shed linked forever now to the first holiday season he could remember. Standing on the pier in Headley, looking across the river led to the lake by the cottage where he would fish with his grandpa. Naming the sculptures in his father's backyard became a chess set on the mantle. The wall was still breathing, though, no matter what he did. The impact of a long-ago linebacker's helmet to the chest during a scrimmage, surfacing only now so that he had trouble breathing, all the air knocked out of his lungs. Control didn't remember leaving the corridor, but had recovered himself in mid-sprint toward the cafeteria, Whitby's terroir manuscript clench in a vice-like grip. He meant to retrieve some other things from his office. He meant to go into his office and retrieve some other things. His office. His other things. He was pulling every fire alarm he passed. He was shouting over the klaxon at people who weren't there to leave. Disbelief. Shock. Trapped inside his head the way some were trapped in the science division. But in the cafeteria he was running so fast he slipped and fell. When he got up, he saw Grace, holding open the door leading to the courtyard. Someone to tell. Someone to tell. There was only wall. There was only wall. He shouted her name, but Grace did not turn. And as he came up on her, he saw that she stared at someone slowly walking up from the edge of the courtyard through a thick rain, against the burnt umber of the singed edges of the swamp beyond. A tall, dark outline lit by the late afternoon sun, shining through the downpour. He would recognize her anywhere by now, still in her expedition clothes, so close to a gnarled tree behind her that at first she had merged with it in the gray of the rain, and she was still making her way to Grace, and Grace, in three-quarter profile there in front of her, smiling, body taut with anticipation. This false return, this corrupted reunion, this end of everything. For the director trailed plumes of emerald dust, and behind her the nature of the world was changing, filling with a brightness, the rain losing its depth, its darkness, the thickness of the layers of the rain getting lost. Taken away, no longer there. The border was coming to the southern reach. In the parking lot, shoving the key into the ignition, office forgotten, not wanting to look back, not wanting to see if an invisible wave was about to overtake him, Still cars in the parking lot, still people inside, but he didn't care. He was leaving. He was done. A scrabbling, broken nail panic at the thought of being trapped there. Forever, shouting at the car to start after it had already started, he raced for the gates. Open. No security. No sound from behind him at all. Just a vast silence, snuffing out thought. His hands were curled, claw-like, fingers dragging into his palms as he clutched the wheel. Speeding, not caring about anything but making it to Headley, even though he knew that might not be any kind of choice at all. Pulling out his phone, dropping it, but not stopping, groping for it as he reached the highway, screeched onto the on-ramp, relieved to see normal traffic. He stifled a dozen impulses, to stop the car and use it to block off the exit, to roll down his window in the rain and shout out a warning to the other motorists, stifled any impulse that impeded the deep and impervious instinct to get away. Two fighter jets roared overhead, but he couldn't see them. He kept changing the radio channels to current news reports, not sure what would be reported, but wanting something to be reported even though it was still happening, hadn't finished yet. Nothing. No one. Kept trying to get the feel of the wall off his hand, wiping it against the seats, the steering wheel, his pants, would have plunged it into dog shit to get the feeling off. When he turned away from Grace, he'd seen that Whitby occupied his usual seat in the back of the cafeteria, under the photograph of the old days. But Whitby came in only intermittently now, the transmission garbled, some of the words in tone and texture still recalled human speech. Others recalled the video from the first expedition. Whitby had failed some fundamental test, had crossed some Rubicon, and now sat there, jaw oddly elongated as he tried to get words out. Alone, beyond Control's help, he realized then, or at some point later, that maybe Whitby wasn't just crazy. That Whitby had become a breach, a leak, a door into Area X, expressed as an elongated equation over time, and if the director had now come back to the Southern Reach, it wasn't because of, or for, Grace. It was because Whitby had been calling out to her like a human beacon, this version of her that had returned. Trapped by his thoughts, that the Southern Reach hadn't been a redoubt, but instead some kind of slow incubator, that finding Whitby's shrine might have triggered something, that placing trust in a word like border had been a mistake, a trap, a slow unraveling of terms unrecognized until too late. Whitby's gaze had followed him in his flight toward the front entrance, and Control had run almost sideways to make sure Whitby never left his view until the corner took him. He could see the Leviathans from his dream clearly now, staring at him, seeing him with an awful clarity. He had not escaped their attention. Calling his mother, "Hypnotize me. Hypnotize this out of me," unable to reach her, leaving messages shouted out, half-coherent. The corridor leading into Headley in the banality of rush-hour traffic, the mundane quality of the rain coming down, feeling the pressure behind him, tried to control his breathing. Every bit of advice his mother had ever given him had gotten knocked out of his head. Had it stopped? Had the director stopped? Or was it still on rushing? Was an invisible blot now seeping out across the world? Already reviewing in his mind as he began to recover, began to function, what he could have done differently, what, if anything, might have made a difference, or if it was always going to happen like this, in this universe, on this day. "I'm sorry," he said inside the car, to no one, to Grace, to Cheney, even to Whitby. "I'm sorry, but for what? What was his role in this?" As he reached the bottom of the hill, leading up to his house, the radio reports began to reflect his reality in slivers and glints of light. Something had occurred at the military base, perhaps related to the continuing environmental cleanup efforts, There had been an odd glow and odd sounds and gunfire, but no one knew anything, not for sure, except that Control now knew the thing that had been eluding him, hiding in the deeper waters for him to recognize it, revealed now, too late to do any good, for in the stooped shoulders and the tilt of the director's head, there, approaching in the flesh, Control had finally realized that the girl in the photograph with the lighthouse keeper was the director as a child. There was a kind of slouch or lurch to the shoulders that, despite the different perspectives and the difference in years, was unmistakable if you were looking for it. Now that he could see it, he couldn't unsee it. There, hiding in plain sight in the photograph from the director's wall, was a photograph of the director as a child taken by the S&S Brigade, standing side by side with Saul Evans, whose words decorated the wall of the topographical anomaly in living tissue. She had looked at that photo every day in her office. She had chosen to place that photograph there. She had chosen to live in Bleakersville in a house full of heirlooms, probably owned by someone on her mother's side of the family, who at the Southern Reach had known. Or had this been another conspiracy of one, and the director had hidden that connection all on her own? Assuming he was right, she had been at the lighthouse right before the event. She had gotten out before the border came down. She knew the Forgotten Coast like she knew herself. There were things that she'd never had to put down on paper just because of who she was, where she came from. For all Control knew, the director had been one of the last people to see Saul Evans alive. He pulled up in front of the house, sat there a moment, feeling beat up, drained, unable to process what was happening. Sweat dripped off him, his shirt drenched, his blazer lost back at the Southern Reach. He got out of the car, searched the hidden horizon beyond the river. Was that a faint flare-up of light? Was that the muffled echo of explosions, or his imagination? When he turned to the porch, a woman was standing on the steps next to the cat. He felt relief, more than surprise. "Hello, Mother." She looked almost the same as always, but the high fashion had a slight bulk to it, which meant under the chic dark red jacket she probably had on some sort of light body armor. She'd also be carrying. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, which made the lines of her face more severe. Her features bore the stress of an ongoing puzzlement and pain of some kind. "Hello, son," she said as he brushed by her. Control let her talk at him as he opened the front door, then went into the bedroom and began to pack. Most of his clothes were still clean and folded in the drawers. It was easy to fit some of them quickly and neatly into his suitcase, to pack his toiletries from the adjoining bathroom, to get out the briefcase full of money, passports, guns, and credit cards, wondering what to bring with him from the living room in terms of personal effects. Definitely a piece from the chessboard. He wasn't hearing much of what his mother was saying, staying focused on the task in front of him, in doing it perfectly. Grace had stood there waiting to receive the director, and he had pleaded with her to leave, pleaded with her to turn from the door and to run like hell for some kind of safety, but she wouldn't do it. Wouldn't let him pull her away, had summoned a reserve of strength that was too much against his panic, but let him see the gun concealed in a shoulder holster, as if that might be a comfort. "I have my orders and they are no concern of yours." As he fell out of her orbit, fell free of everything at the Southern Reach, his mother forced him to stop packing, closed the suitcase, which he had piled too high anyway, and took his hand, put something in it. "Take this," she said. "A pill. A little white pill."
"What is it?"
"Just take it."
"Why not just hypnotize me?"
She ignored him, guided him to a chair in the corner. He sat there, heavy and cold in his own sweat. "We will talk after you take the pill, after you take a shower," said in a sharp tone, the one she used with him to cut off discussion or debate.
"I don't have time for a shower," he said,
staring at the wallpaper, which began to blur. Now he would inhabit the very center of corridors. He would put no hand to any surface. He would behave like a ghost that knew if it made contact with anyone or anything, its touch would slide through, and that creature would then know that it existed in a state of purgatory. Severance slapped him hard across the face, and he could hear right again.
"You've had a shock? I can see that you've had a shock, son. I've had a few myself the last few hours. But I need you to start thinking again. I need you present."
He looked up at her, so like and unlike his mother. "Okay," he said. "Okay." He took the pill, lurched to his feet while he had the will, headed for the bathroom. There had been nothing recognizable in the director's eyes, nothing at all. In the shower, he started to cry because he still couldn't get the feel of the wall off his hand, no matter how hard he tried. Couldn't shake the thinning of the rain, the look on Whitby's face, Grace's rigid stance, or the fact that it all happened only an hour ago and he was still trying to piece it together. But when he stumbled out, dried himself off, and put on a t-shirt and jeans, he felt calmer, almost normal. There was still a slight wobble, but the pill must have kicked in. He used hand sanitizer, but the texture remained on his hand like an unshakable phantom. His mother was making coffee in the kitchen, but he went past her without a word, through the sudden cold of the air conditioning vent, and opened the front door, letting in a blast of humidity and heat. It had stopped raining. He could see down to the river, to a horizon that held somewhere the southern reach. Everything was quiet and still, but there were vague coronas of green light, of purple light that shouldn't be there. A vision of whatever was in Area X spilling out over the land, spreading out across the river to Headley.
"You won't see much from here," his mother said from behind him. "They're still attempting containment."
"How far has it spread?" he asked, shaking a bit as he closed the door and entered the kitchen. He took a sip of the coffee she had set in front of him. It was bitter, but it took his mind off his hand.
"I won't lie, John. It's bad.
The southern reach is lost. The new border isn't far beyond the gates. They're all trapped in there." The suggestion of the rain thinning behind the director, Grace, Whitby, who knew who else, caught up in a true nightmare now.
"It might stop there for a very long time."
"You're full of shit," he said. "You don't know what it will do."
"Or it might speed up. You're right, we can't know."
"That's right, we can't. I was there, right in the middle of it. I saw it coming."
"Because you put me there." A howl inside of betrayal, and then a thought that struck him when he saw the tired, worried look on her face.
"But there's more, isn't there? Something more you haven't told me."
There always was. Even now she hesitated, didn't want to divulge a secret classified in a country that might not exist in a week. Then said in a flat voice,
"The contamination at the sites from which we extracted the surveyor and the anthropologist has broken through quarantine and continued to grow despite our best efforts."
"Jesus Christ,"
he said. Even through the dulling effects of the pill, he wanted to be rid of his itching brain, his ignited skin, the flesh beneath, to in some way become so ethereal and unbound to the earth that he could unsee, disavow.
What kind of contamination? Although he thought he knew.
"The kind that cleanses everything. The kind you can't see until it's too late."
"There's nothing you can do?"
A rasping laugh escaped her, like she was trying to cough something up.
"What are we going to do, John? Are we going to combat it by starting a mining operation there? Pollute those places to hell and back? Put places of heavy metals in the water supply?"
He just stared at her, unbelieving.
"Why the fuck did you station me at the Southern Reach if you knew this could happen?
I wanted you to close it. I wanted you to know because that protects you.
That protects me? Against the end of the world?
Maybe. Maybe it does, and we needed fresh eyes, she said, leaning beside him against the kitchen counter. He always forgot how slight she was, how thin. I needed your fresh eyes. I couldn't know that things would change this fast.
But you had a clue it might.
She kept letting drop bits of information. Was he meant to pick them up, like the gun under the seat, just because she was unraveling?
Yes, I had a clue, John. It's why we sent you. Why a few of us thought we needed to do something.
Like Lowry.
Yes, like Lowry.
Lowry, hiding back at Central, unable to face what had happened, as if the videos were now spilling into real life.
You let him hypnotize me. You let them condition me.
Unable to suppress his resentment at that, even now, he might never know the extent of it.
I'm sorry, but that was the trade-off, John,
she said, resolute, sticking to her story.
That was the trade-off. I got the person I want for the job. Lowry got some kind of control, and you got protection, in a way.
Derisive, thinking he knew the answer. How many others are there at Central, Mother, in this faction?
Mostly just us, John. Lowry and me, but Lowry has allies. Many,
she said in a small voice. Just them. A cabal of two against a cabal of one, the director, and none of them seeming to have it right, and now all of it in ruins.
What else?
Pushing to punish her because he didn't want to think about the idea of localized Area X's. A bitter laugh.
We back-checked the extraction locations of the members of the last 11th expedition to see if they exhibit a similar effect. We found nothing. So now we think they probably had a different purpose, and that purpose was to contaminate the Southern Reach itself. We had clues before, we just didn't interpret them the right way, couldn't agree on what it all meant. We just needed a little more time, a little more data.
Bodies that had decomposed a little faster, as Grace had put it, when the director had ordered them exhumed. There was in his mother's fragmentation the admission that Central's was a soul-crushing failure, that they had been unable to conceive of a scenario in which Area X was smarter, more insidious, more resourceful. None of this could obliterate the look on Grace's face in the rain as the director approached. The elation, the vindication, the abstract idea viscerally expressed across her features, that sacrifice, that loyalty, that diligence would now be rewarded. As if the physical manifestation of a friend and colleague long thought dead could erase the recent past. The director, followed by that unnatural silence. Were her eyes closed? Or did she not have eyes anymore? The emerald dust splashed off her into the air, onto the ground with each step. This person who should not have been there, this shell of a soul of whom he had uncovered only fragments. His mother started over, and he let her, because he had no choice, needed time to acclimate, to adjust. Imagine a situation, John, in which you are trying to contain something dangerous, but you suspect that containment is a losing game, that what you want to contain is escaping slowly, inexorably, that what seems impermeable is, in fact, over time becoming very permeable, that the divide is more perforated than unperforated, and that whatever this thing is seems to want to destroy you, but has no leader to negotiate with, no stated goals of any kind.
It was almost a speech he could imagine the director giving. You mean the Southern Reach, the place you sent me into, with the wrong tools.
I mean that the group I've been part of has believed for a while now that the Southern Reach might be compromised, but the majority have believed, until today, that this wasn't just wrong but laughably ridiculous.
How did you get involved?
Because of you, John. Long ago. Because of needing an assignment to a place near where you and your father lived.
Volunteered.
It was a side project, something to watch, to keep an eye on, that became the main course.
But why did it have to be me?
I told you,
pleading for him to understand.
I know you, John. I know who you are. I'd know if you changed.
Like the biologist changed.
Burning now, that she'd put him in harm's way without telling him, without giving him the choice. Except he'd had a choice. He could have stayed where he was, continued to believe he lived beyond the border when that was a lie.
Something like that.
Or just changed as in became more cynical, jaded, paranoid, or burned out.
Stop it.
Why should I?
I did the best I could.
Yeah.
Growing up, I mean, John, I did the best I could, considering. But you're still angry. Even now, you're still angry. It's too much. It's too much.
Talking around the edge of a catastrophe. But wasn't that what people did if you were still alive? He put his coffee down. There was a knot in his shoulders that might never come out.
I'm not thinking about that. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter now.
It matters most of all now, she said, because I may never see you again.
Her voice, for the only time he could remember, breaking up. The weight of that hit him hard, and he knew it was true, and he felt for a moment as if he were falling. The enormity, the impossibility of it was too much. How it had come to this point, he barely knew, even though he had been there every step of the way. He brought her close, held her as she whispered in his ear.
I took my eye off things. I thought the director agreed with us. I thought I could handle Lowry. I thought we would work through it. I thought we had more time.
That the problem was smaller, that somehow it was containable, that somehow she wouldn't be hurting him. His mother. His handler. But after a moment he had to let her go. No way to fully cross that divide, to heal everything that needed to be healed, not now. She told him one more thing then, delivered to him like a penance.
John, you should know that the biologist escaped our custody over the weekend. She's been AWOL for the past 3 days.
An elation, a surge of an unwarranted, selfish euphoria that came in part from having banished her from his thoughts as the nightmare at the Southern Reach played out, and now his reward, that she had, in a way, been returned to him. All of the rest of the answers to his questions rose up later, long after his mother had left in his car, after he had packed, reluctantly abandoned the cat, took her car, as she had suggested, but he stopped on a quiet street a few blocks away and hot-wired another car because he didn't trust Central. Soon he was outside of Headley, in the middle of nowhere. He felt the absence of his father terribly as he passed where they had lived, because his father might have been a comfort now. Because now it didn't matter what secrets he told or didn't tell. At the airport about 90 miles away, in a city big enough to have international connections, he left his vehicle in the parking lot along with his guns and booked 2 tickets. One was to Honduras, with a layover on the West Coast. The other had 2 layovers and wound up about 200 miles from the coast. The second he bought under an alias. He checked in for Honduras, then sat in the airport bar nursing a whiskey, waiting for the puddle jumper. Apocalyptic visions of what Area X would absorb if it moved forward came to him. Buildings, roads, lakes, valleys, airports, everything. He scanned the closed captioned televisions for any news, trying to outthink the people from Central who might be on her trail, might already have picked up her trail. If he was the biologist, he would have train-hopped to start, which meant he might easily catch up with her. From where she'd escaped, she had just as far to travel as he did. A blonde woman at the bar asked him what he did, and he said, recklessly, without a thought, "A marine biologist."
"Oh, with the government?"
"No, freelance."
which sounded absurd after he'd said it, then spent long minutes putting distance between himself and the subject, because he wanted to stay there, at the bar, around people but not involved with them. "How'd she escape?" he'd asked his mother. "Let's just say she's stronger than she looks and very resourceful." Had his mother given her the resources, the time, the opportunity? He hadn't wanted to ask. "Central suspects she will return to the empty lot because of the lack of contamination at that site." But he knew that wasn't where she would go.
"Is that what you think?" his mother asked.
"Yes," he said. "No, she would go north. She would go to the wilderness above the town of Rock Bay. Even if she didn't believe she was the biologist, she would go somewhere personal to her, because she felt the urge, not because Area X wanted her to. If she had been right, if she'd been their true soldier, she would have been as mind-wiped as the others. At least, that's what he chose to believe, to have a reason for his packing and a place to think of as a sanctuary or a hiding place. They announced boarding for his flight. He was headed west, yes, but he'd step out at the first connecting flight, rent a car from there, take that rental to another, then perhaps steal a car, always the arc going south-south, suggesting a slow descent, but then he'd go dark completely and head north. He'd actually pulled at Grace to get her away, had taken her hand and pulled her off balance, would have dragged her if he'd been able, shouted at her, given her all the reasons, the primal, visceral reasons. But Grace couldn't see any of it, wrenched away from him with a stare that made him give up. Because it was self-aware. Because she was going to see it through to the end, and he couldn't do that. Because he really wasn't the director. So he let Grace fade away into the rain as the director came up toward the door, and he retreated in mindless panic to the cafeteria, and then out to his car, and he didn't feel guilty about any of it. A beep from his phone told him that, coming in over some unimaginable distance, he had received the last useless videos from the southern reach, from the chicken and the goat. The footage told him nothing, gave him no closure, no sense of what might have happened to Grace. The quality was grainy, indistinct. Each clip was about 6 seconds in duration, and each cut off at the same time. In the first, his chair sat empty until the very end, when something blurred appeared to sit down. It might have been the director, but the outline was ill-defined. The other video showed a slumped Whitby in the chair opposite, doing something peculiar with his hands that made his fingers look like soft coral swaying in a sea current. A wordless droning in the background. Was Whitby now in the world of the first expedition, and if so, did he know it? Control watched both video clips twice, thrice, and then deleted them. This act did not delete the subjects, but it made him more distant from them, and that would have to be good enough. The usual influx of heat, and then frigid cold on the airplane, the grappling with frayed seat belts. As they rose, Control kept waiting for something to swat the plane out of the sky, wondered if Central would be there to greet him when he touched down. Or something odder still. He wondered why the stewardesses were looking at him funny by mid-flight, and realized he'd been responding to their rote kindness with the intensity of someone who has never experienced courtesy, or never expects to experience it again. The couple in the seats next to him were of the annoying yet ordinary type, who said almost everything for their audience, or to affirm their own couplehood. Yet even them he wanted to warn, in a sudden, unexpected outpouring of raw and almost uncontainable emotion, to somehow articulate what was happening, what was going to happen, without sounding crazy, without scaring them or him. But ultimately, he popped another calm pill, and leaned back in his seat and tried to banish the world. "How do I know that going after the biologist isn't an idea you've put in my head?"
"The biologist was the director's weapon, I believe. You said in your report she doesn't act like the others. Whatever she knows, She represents a kind of chance, some kind of chance.
Control hadn't shared with his mother the full experience of his last moments at the Southern Reach. Not everything he had seen, or that whatever the director was now, or wherever she'd grown up, she was less herself than at any point in the past. That whatever plan she'd had was probably irrelevant.
"And you are my weapon, John. You're the one I chose to know everything."
The comfort of the scratched metal armrests with the fat, torn padding on top, the compartmentalized scoops of sky captured by the oval windows, the captain's unnecessary progress reports, interspersed with the stupid but comforting jokes over the intercom. He wondered where the voice was, if Lowry was having flashbacks or freaking out in a more general way. Lowry, his buddy. Lowry, the pathetic megalodon. "This is your last chance, Control," but it wasn't. It was instead an immolation. If he was remembered at all, it would be as the harbinger of disaster. He ordered a whiskey with ice, to see it gleam, to keep the ice in his mouth and experience the smooth cold with the hint of bite. It helped him fall into a lull, a trough of self-induced tiredness, trying to slow the wheels of his mind, trying to wreck those wheels.
"What will Central do now?" he'd asked his mother.
"They'll come after you because of your association with me."
"Would have come after him anyway for not reporting in and for going after the biologist." "What else will they do?"
"Try to send in a 13th expedition if a door still exists."
"And what about you?"
"I'll keep making the case for the course I think is right," she said, which she had to know was a huge risk. Did that mean she'd go back? Or keep some distance from Central until the situation stabilized? Because Control knew that she would keep fighting until the world disappeared around her. Or Central got rid of her, or Lowry used her as a scapegoat. Did she think Central wouldn't try to blame the messenger? He could have asked why she didn't just liquidate her savings and head for the most remote place possible, and wait. But if he had, she would have asked him the same thing. At the end of the flight, a woman in the aisle seat opposite told him and his two seatmates to open their window for landing.
"You gotta open the window for landing. You gotta open it. For landing."
Or what? Or what? He just ignored her, did not pass the message on, closed his eyes. When he opened them, the plane had landed. No one waited for him as he disembarked. No one called out his name. He rented a car without incident. It was as if a different person put the key in the ignition and drove away from everything that was familiar. There was no going back now. There was no going forward either. He was going in sideways, sort of. And as frightening as that was, there was the thrill of excitement, too. You couldn't feel dead this way, or as if you were just waiting for the next thing to happen to you. Rock Bay. The end of the world. If she wasn't there, it was a better place than most to wait for whatever happened next. Dusk of the next day. In a crappy motel on the coast with the word beach in its name, Control obsessively stripped and cleaned his Glock, bought off a dealer using a fake name not 30 minutes after he'd cleared the airport in the back lot of a car dealership, then reassembled it. Having to focus on a repetitive and detailed task kept his mind off the void looming outside. The television was on, but nothing made sense. The television, except for the vaguest of footnotes about a possible problem at the Southern Reach Environmental Recovery Site, did not tell the truth about what was going on, but it hadn't made sense for a very long time, even if no one knew that, and he knew his contempt would mirror that of the biologist, if she had been sitting where he was sitting, and the light from the curtains was just a stray truck barreling by in the dark. And the smell was of rot, but he thought perhaps he'd brought that with him. Even though he was far away from it now, the invisible border was close. The checkpoints, the swirling light of the door. The way that light seemed almost beveled,
almost formed an image in that space between the curtains, and then fell away again into nothing. On the bed, Whitby's terroir manuscript, which he hadn't looked at since leaving Headley. All he'd done was put it in a sturdy, waterproof plastic case. He kept realizing, with a kind of resigned surprise, a kind of slow registering or reimagining meant to cushion the blow, that the invasion had been underway for quite some time, had been manifesting for much longer than anyone could have guessed, even his mother, and that perhaps Whitby had figured something out. Even if no one had believed him, even if figuring it out had exposed him to something that had then figured him out. When he was finished with the Glock, he sat in a chair facing the door, clenching the grip tight, even though it made his fingers throb. It was another way to keep from being overwhelmed by it. Pain as distraction. All of his familiar guides had gone silent. His mother, his grandparents, his father. None of them had anything to say to him. Even the carving in his pocket seemed inert, useless now. And the whole time, sitting in the chair, then lying in the bed with its worn blanket and yellowing sheets with cigarette burns in them, Control could not get the image of the biologist out of his head. The look on her face in the empty lot. That blankness, and then, later in the sessions, the warring of contempt. Wildness, casual vulnerability and vehemence, strength, that had laid him low. That had expanded until it hooked into the whole of him, no part of him not committed, even though she might never know. Could give two shits about him, even though he would be content should he never meet her again, just so long as he could believe she was still out there, alive and on her own. The yearnings in him now went in all directions, and no direction at all. It was an odd kind of affection that needed no subject, that emanated from him like invisible rays meant for everyone and everything. He supposed they were normal feelings once you'd pushed on past a certain point. North is where the biologist had fled, and he knew where she would end up. It was right there in her field notes, a precipice she knew better than almost anyone, where the land fell away into the sea, and the sea rushed up onto the rocks. He just had to be prepared. Central might catch up to him before he got there, but lurking behind them might be something even darker and more vast. And that was the killing joke, that the thing catching up with all of them would be even less merciful and would question them until, like a towel wrung dry and then left out in the sun, they were nothing but brittle husks and hollows. Unless he made it north in time, if she was there, if she knew anything. He left the motel early, just as the sun appeared, grabbed breakfast at a cafe, and continued north. Here it was all cliffs and sharp curves, and the sense that you might dive off into the sky around each upward bend, that the little thought you always overrode, to stop turning the wheel to match the road, might not be stifled this time, and you'd gun the engine and push on into the air, and snuff out every secret thing you knew and didn't want to know. The temperature rarely rose above 75, and the landscape soon became lush, the greens more intense than in the south, the rain, when it came, a kind of mist, so unlike the hellish downpours he'd become used to. At a general store in a tiny town called Selk that had a gas station whose antiquated pumps didn't take credit cards, he bought a large knapsack, filled it with about 30 pounds of supplies. He bought a hunting knife, plenty of batteries, an axe, lighters, and a lot more. He didn't know what he'd need or how much she'd need, how long he might be out there in the wilderness searching for her. Would her reaction be what he wanted it to be? And what reaction was that? Assuming she was even there, he imagined himself years from now, bearded, living off the land, making carvings like his father, alone, slowly fading into the backdrop from the weight of solitude. The cashier asked him his name as part of a sales pitch for a local charity, and he said, John, and from that point on he used his real name again. Not Control, not any of the aliases that had gotten him this far. It was a common name. It didn't stand out. It didn't mean anything. He continued the tactics he'd been using, though. Domestic terrorism had made him familiar with a lot of rural areas. For his second assignment out of training, he had spent time in the Midwest on the road between county health departments, under the guise of helping update immunization software, but he'd really been tracking down data on members of a militia. He knew back roads from that other life and took to them as if he'd never left, used all the tricks with no effort, although it had been a long time since he'd used them. There was even a kind of stressful freedom to it, an exhilaration and simplicity he hadn't known for a long time. Then, like now, he'd doubted every pickup truck, especially if it had a mud-obscured license plate, every slow driver, every hitchhiker. Then, as now, he'd picked local roads with dirt side roads that allowed him to double back. He used detailed printed maps, no GPS. He had almost wavered on his cell phone, but had thrown it into the ocean, hadn't bought a temporary to replace it. He knew he could have bought something that couldn't be traced, but anyone he called would no doubt be bugged by now. The urge to call any of his relatives, to try his mother one last time, had faded with the miles. If he'd had something to say, he should have picked up the phone a long time ago. Sometimes he thought of the director as he drove, along the banks of a glistening, shallow lake in a valley surrounded by mountains, ripping off pieces of sausage bought at a farmer's market, the color of the sky so light a blue, yet so untroubled by clouds that it didn't seem real. The girl in the old black-and-white photo, the way she had fixated on the lighthouse but never referred to the lighthouse keeper, because she had been there. Because she had been there until almost the end. What had she seen? What had she known? Who had known about her? Had Grace known? The hard work to find the levers and means to eventually be hired by the Southern Reach. Had anyone along the way known her secret and thought it was a good idea, as opposed to a compromising of the agency? Why was she hiding what she knew about the lighthouse keeper? These questions worried at him. Missed opportunities. Being behind. Too much focus on plant and mouse, on the voice, on Whitby, or maybe he would have seen it earlier. The files he still had with him didn't help. Having the photograph there in the passenger seat didn't help. Driving through the night now, he came back to the coast again and again, his headlights reflecting orange dashes and white reflectors and sometimes the silver gray of a railing. He had stopped listening to the news on the radio. He didn't know if the subtle hints of impending catastrophe he gleaned existed only in his imagination. He wanted, more and more, to pretend that he existed in a bubble without context, that the drive would last forever, that the journey was the point. When he grew too tired, he stopped in a town whose name he forgot as soon as he left, having coffee and eggs at a 24-hour diner. The waitress asked him where he was headed, and he just said, "North." She nodded, didn't ask him anything else, must have seen something in his face that discouraged it. He didn't linger, cut his meal short, nervous about the black sedan with the tinted windows in the parking lot, the battered old Volvo with the rainforest stickers on it, whose owner had been slouched out there smoking a cigarette for a little too long. The rain from off the sea thickened into fog, brought him to a 20-mile-an-hour crawl in the dark, never sure what would come out of the haze at him. Once a truck rattled his frame to the core. Once a deer danced briefly past the headlights like a moving canvas, then was gone. He came to the conclusion in the early dawn that it didn't matter if his mother had lied to him. It was a tactical detail, not strategic. He was always going to pursue this course, convinced himself that once he had gone to the Southern Reach that he was always going to be on this road in the middle of nowhere, headed north. The gnarled, wind-torn trees became a dark, haphazard smoke in the mist, self-immolating into ash, as if he were seeing some version of the future. The night before he would reach the town of Rock Bay, John let himself have a last meal. he pulled into a fancy restaurant in a town that lay in the shadow of the coastal mountains, cupped by the curve of a river that looked anemic next to the waves and striations of different colored sand radiating out from the water. Scattered piles of driftwood and dead trees looked as if they'd been placed there to hold it all down. He sat at the bar, ordered a bottle of good red wine, a petite filet with garlic, mashed potatoes, and mushroom gravy. He listened to the humble brag of Jan, the experienced bartender, with a deliberately naive enthusiasm, entertaining stories from stints working overseas in cities John had never visited. The man stared furtively at John at times. From a craggy Nordic face bordered by long yellow hair, wondering, perhaps, if John would ask him what he was doing among the driftwood here at the butt end of the world. A family came in, rich, white, in polo shirts and sweaters and khaki pants as if from a clothing catalog, oblivious of him, oblivious of the bartender, ordering burgers and fries, the father sitting directly to John's left, shielding his kids from the stranger. Exactly how strange, they could not know. They existed in their own bubble. They had just about everything and knew almost nothing. Their conversation was all about sitting up straight and chewing what they ate and a football game they'd watched, and some tourist shop down in the village. He didn't envy them. He didn't hate them. He felt a curious nothing about them. All of the history here, everything encoded, rendered meaningless. None of it could mean anything next to the secret knowledge he carried with him. The bartender shot John a roll of the eyes as he patiently put up with the kids changing orders and the subtle condescension in the way the father talked to him, while the woman in the military uniform and her two skateboarder friends from Empire Street gathered ethereal to either side of John, staring at the family's meal with unabashed hunger. How many operatives went unremarked upon, never registered, were never heard from, never sustained, snuffed out in darkness and crappy safe houses and dank motels, made invisible, made irrelevant, and how many could have been him, were still him, laboring here, unbeknownst to this family or even the bartender, still trying, even though it wasn't just the border to Area X that negated people, but everyone in the world beyond. When the family had left, and along with them his companions, he asked the bartender, "Where can I get a boat?" In an agreeably conspiratorial way, a fellow world-weary traveler, his tone implied, a fellow adventurer who sometimes ignored legality in the same way as the bartender did in his stories. "You're the man. You can hook me up." "You know boats?" Jan asked. "Yes. On lakes, close to shore, anything more and he'd be the punchline of one of Jack's jokes." "Maybe I can help," the bartender said with a grin. "Maybe I could arrange that." The fractured light from a chandelier composed of glass globes lit up his face as he leaned in to whisper, "How soon do you need it?" "Now, immediately, by the morning." Because he wasn't going to drive into Rock Bay. The Living with Salt was a modified flat-bottom skiff with a shallow bow and a stubborn reluctance to turn starboard with any kind of grace. It had a tiny shed of a cabin that would give him some relief from the strong ocean winds and a powerful, if seasoned, motor. It was ancient, and the white paint had flaked, exposing the wood beneath. It almost looked like a tugboat to John, but had been used as a fishing vessel by the grizzled, barrel-bellied, bow-legged walking cliché of a fisherman who sold it to him for twice what it was worth. He almost thought the man had some illegal side business, must also be playing a part. He bought enough gasoline to either blow him sky-high or last until the end of the world and loaded in the rest of his supplies. It came with oars, for if the motor should give out, and nautical maps, "Though God help you if you don't seek shelter, there's a storm," and a flare gun. After a little persuading that involved more money, it also came with the skipper's old raincoat, hat, pipe, galoshes, and a fishing net with a hole in it. The pipe felt weird in his mouth,
and the galoshes were a bit too big, but it made him believe that from a distance his disguise might hold. The motor had a ragged, hiccuping mutter he didn't like, but he had little choice, and he believed the boat might be as fast as the car on the treacherous roads that lay ahead and harder to trace. As he lurched downriver toward the sea, he had a sense of impending apocalypse, the beached and blackened driftwood evidence, not of bonfires and storms, but of some more radical catastrophe. Old houses lay among the rocks of the coast and the few crude beaches as he chugged along through choppy waters and calm waters, struggling to learn the jump and list of the boat, slowly adjusting to the current. Most of the houses were falling apart, and even those awake with lights at dusk seemed only temporarily resurrected. Smoke from grills, people on piers below. They all looked like they'd be gone by winter. He passed an abandoned lighthouse, a low, squat white tower with a black crown. It slid past in silence, the fitted stones showing through the ruined paint, the beacon dark, and he had a startled sense of doubling, as if he were somehow traveling up the coast of an alternative Area X, this sense that he had passed beyond some boundary. Somewhere in the fog, if he looked closely, he'd see Lowry and Whitby wandering lost. Somewhere, too, the Seance and Science Brigade taking their measurements, and Saul Evans walking up the spiral steps of the lighthouse with a girl, oblivious, playing on the rocks below. Perhaps even Grace gathering the remnants of the southern reach around her. By mid-afternoon, he had reached the part of the coast where the land curved sharply, an inlet that led to the town of Rock Bay. What the biologist called Rock Bay was actually the tidal pools and reefs that lay about 20 miles north of town, but her former cottage had been right outside of the town, or village, if you wanted to be specific, because it only had about 500 residents. The living with salt wasn't the kind of boat that John could pull up onto the shore and hide under branches, but he wanted to do a recon of Rock Bay before moving on. He chanced going a little ways up the wide inlet, half hidden by rock islands that jutted out from the water. Soon he spotted a rotten old pier where he could tie up. According to the maps, it was close enough to the local wildlife refuge that he could walk from there and intersect a hiking trail, following it close to the town. He left behind his hat and pipe and, taking his raincoat, binoculars, and gun, made his way inland through scrubland and then forest. The smell of fresh cedar invigorated him. Soon enough, he was looking down from a bluff at the wooden bridge leading into town and the tiny main street beyond. He'd come across a roadblock manned by local police well before the bridge, but he'd seen nothing suspicious on the trails. Just a jogger and a couple of teenagers clearly looking for a place to smoke pot. From his vantage now, looking down with his binoculars through the intense tree cover, though, he could see half a dozen black sedans and SUVs with tinted windows parked on the main street. The vehicles reeked of Central, as did the two coiffed would-be lumberjacks who stood near the vehicles in bright plaid shirts and jeans and boots that looked too new to have yet been through a slog. If they had come in such small numbers, then either this location was one of many being searched, or the biologist was by now only part of a much larger problem, Central fully occupied elsewhere. Somewhere in the south, perhaps. Depending on how well they knew the biologist's habits, they might believe that she'd prefer to hide somewhere farther north, along the coastline. But they'd have to rule out the town and its environs first. All around was dense coastal scrubland or even denser rainforest, none of it easy to traverse, the kind of terroir even experienced locals could get lost in once you went beyond the town, especially during the rainy season. On a hunch, he abandoned his position on the bluff and took a trail down and across the stream straddled by the wooden bridge, then up the opposite side back onto a rise that eventually led him over a series of moss-covered, cedar-rich hills. into a position near the water. Opposite him, across the narrow inlet, lay the cottage where the biologist had lived. He crept in, hunched over, zigzag fashion, through the breaks in the sharp bramble, lay among twisted black trees with thorny leaves at a good vantage point. The cottage was only a little larger than his boat, and just enough forest had been cleared for a tiny lawn in front and to let a dirt road curl up the rise to the left. Beyond that rise, hidden, lay a larger settlement, a main house from which he could see a tendril of white smoke rising via an obscured chimney. But no smoke rose from the cottage. Nothing stirred around the cottage either, in a way that he found unnatural. He kept scanning the woods to either side until after about an hour, after about 50 sweeps of the area, he realized that a patch of ground had moved. Camouflage, which, after a few moments, resolved into a man with a rifle and scope stretched out beneath a military-style blind covering the cottage. Once he'd spotted one operative, others came clear to him, in trees, behind logs, even staring out in one uncareful moment from the cottage itself. He knew the biologist would not now come anywhere near the cottage, if she'd ever wanted to. So he retreated into the wilderness and made his way back to his boat by a circuitous and tiring route. He didn't think he had been spotted, but he didn't want to leave it to chance. Thankful, too, to be back at the boat. He'd exhausted his small store of rusty woodcraft and felt he had been lucky. Lucky, too, that his boat was still there and the area still seemed deserted. He ate a can of cold beans and cast off, hugging the coast until the last moment, and then making a calm and steady run across the mouth of the inlet, certain that somehow he would be uncovered from afar and Central would swoop down on him. Yet, despite how wide the expanse seemed in those moments, there were only the seagulls and the pelicans, the cormorants, and high above what he thought might be an albatross, only the choppy waves and a distant foghorn, and the dim shapes of boats closer in and farther out. Nothing that didn't look local, no fisherman who looked newly minted. Easier, better, to go farther away from all of this. She would be in the most desolate, isolated place she could find, daring anyone to follow her. Either there or not. If not, it was all useless anyway. Pursuit felt like an intermittent pulse. It died away and then picked up again. Through binoculars, he saw a speedboat far off, curving fast toward him. He heard a helicopter, although he couldn't see it, and spent a nervous 20 minutes in pointless fishing with his ripped, useless net, his formless hat pulled down over his forehead, pretending with everything he had to be a fisherman. Then the sounds faded. The speedboat looped back down the coast. Everything was as before, for a very long time. This new landscape above the Rock Bay Inlet was even more foreign to him, and colder, and a relief, as if Area X were just a climate, a type of vegetation, a simple terroir, even if he knew this wasn't true. So many shades and tones of gray, the gray that shone down from the sky, a ceaseless and endless gray that was so still. The mottled, matte gray of the water, before the rain, broken by the curls of wavelets, the gray of the rain itself, prickles and ripples against the ocean's surface. The silver gray of the real waves farther out, which came in and hit the bow as he guided the boat into them, rocking and the engine whining. The gray of something large and ponderous passing underneath him, and making the boat rise as he tried to keep it still and motorless for those moments, holding his breath, life too close to dream for him to exhale. He understood why the biologist liked this part of the world, how you could lose yourself here in 100 ways, how you could even become someone very different from who you thought you were. His thoughts became still for hours of his search. The frenetic need to analyze, to atomize the day or the week fell away from him,
and with it the weight and buzz of human interaction and interference, which could no longer dwell inside his skull. He thought about the silence of fishing on the lake as a child, the long pauses, what his grandpa might say to him in a hushed tone, as if they were in a kind of church. He wondered what he would do if he couldn't find her. Would he go back? Or would he melt into this landscape, become part of what he found here, try to forget what had happened before, and become no more or less than the spray against the bow, the foam against the shore, the wind against his face? There was a comfort to this idea, almost as strong as the urge to find her, a comfort he had not known for a very long time, and many things receded into the distance behind him, seemed ridiculous, or fantastical, or both, were, at their core, unimportant. During the nights of his journey farther north, tied up as best he could where the coastline allowed it, the lee of a rock island large enough to shield him, the bottom able to hold the anchor despite slippery kelp, he began to see strange lights far behind him. They rose and fell and glided across the sea and the sky, some white and some green or purple-tinged. He could not tell if they were searching or defined a purpose less purposeful. But the lights broke the spell, and he turned on the radio that night, holding it to his ear to keep the volume down as he huddled in his sleeping bag. But he only heard a few unintelligible words until static set in, and he did not know if this was because of some catastrophe or the remoteness of his location. The stars above were large and fixed. They existed against a fabric of night as vast and deep as his sleep, his dream. He was tired now, and hungry for something beyond cans and protein bars. He was sick of the sound of the waves and the sound of his boat's engine. It had been 3 days since leaving Rock Bay, and he had caught no sign of her along the coast. Would soon come to the most remote part of the area. He had long since passed the point where anything inland could be reached by road, but only by hiking trail or helicopter or boat, the very edge of anything that could be called Rock Bay. If he kept conserving food and water, he had enough to last another week before he had to turn back. The morning of another day, in a lull, drifting, he rode into an inlet surrounded by black rocks as sharp as shark fins, as craggy as any mountainside. He'd decided to get close because it looked similar to the coastline sketched in the biologist's field entries. The rocks were covered in limpets and starfish, and in the shallows the 100 bristling dark shapes of sea urchins like miniature submerged mines. He had seen no one for 2 days. His arms were sore and aching from rowing. He wanted a hot meal, a bath, some landmark to tell him for certain where he was. The boat had begun to take on water. He spent some time now bailing, his fear of moving even a little ways from shore greater than that of running aground on something jagged. The rocks formed a rough line or ridge all the way back to shore, and it was hard to navigate around them. A swell carried him too close, and he rammed up against them, felt the jarring in his bones. He put out an oar to push off. It slid off smoothly at first, and he had to try again, then frantically rowed until he was a safe distance from the suck and roll. It took him a moment to realize why his oar had slid, why there had been no usual grinding crunch. Someone had been eating the limpets and mussels. The rock had been almost bare except for some kelp. He looked through his binoculars, saw that rocks a little farther in were bare too, and closer to shore, a few showed pale circular marks where the limpets had resisted their picking. No sign of a fire or of habitation nearby, but someone or something had been grazing on them. If a person, he knew it could have been anyone, Yet it was more than he'd had to go on yesterday. Trepidation and relief and a certain indecisiveness warred within him. If a person, whoever it was, might have already seen the boat, he thought to make a landfall there, then reversed himself and rowed back the way he'd come, back down the coast, by just one cove, hidden by another of the huge rocks that rose from the ocean to form an inhospitable island. By then, the boat had taken on more water, and he realized that he was going to spend most of his time bailing, not rowing, or worrying about sinking, not rowing. So he brought the boat up close to shore, dropped anchor, and waded to a little black sand beach sheltered by overhanging trees, sat there gasping for long minutes. This was his last chance. He could try to fix the boat. He could try to turn back, limp back down the coast to Rock Bay. Be done with this, be done with the idea of this forever. Leave the vision of the biologist in his head, never manifesting in front of him, and then just face whatever had been growing there behind him. He wondered what his mother was doing in that moment, where she was. Then a flash of Whitby reaching out a hand from the shelf struck him sideways, and of Grace at the door waiting for the director. He went back out to the boat, took everything useful he could fit into the backpack, including Whitby's terroir manuscript. Staggering a little under the weight of that, he began to make his way back toward the line of black rocks, trying to stay concealed by the tree line. Soon the boat was just a memory, something that had once existed, but not any longer. That night, he noticed lights in the sky, again distant, but coming nearer. He imagined he could hear the sound of a ship's engine, but the lights faded, the sound faded, and he went to sleep to the hush and whisper of the surf. At dusk of the next day, John saw a movement on the rocks, and he trained his binoculars on it. He wanted to believe that the figure was the biologist, that he knew her outline against the worn sky, the way that she moved, but he had only seen her captive, inert, deactivated, different. The first time, he lost her almost immediately from his vantage, some distance from the rocks, couldn't tell if she was coming back in or going farther out. Rocks and form merged and blurred, and then it was night. He waited for the appearance of a light or a fire, but saw neither. If it was the biologist, she was in full survivalist mode. Another day passed, and he saw nothing except seagulls and a gray fox that came to an abrupt halt when it saw him, and then evaporated into the mist that coated everything for far too long. He worried that whoever he had seen had passed on, that this wasn't an outpost, but just another marker on a longer journey. He ate another can of beans, drank sparingly from the water canteen, huddled, shivering beneath deep cover. He was reaching the edge of his woodcraft again, was made more for back roads and small-town surveillance than for living out in the wild. He thought he'd probably lost about 5 pounds. He kept taking in deep breaths of cedar and every green living thing as a temporary antidote. The figure came out at dusk again, crawling and hopping across the sheets of black rock with an expertise John knew would be beyond him. As he identified her as the biologist through the binoculars, his heart leapt and his blood stirred and the little hairs on his arms rose. A flood of emotion came over him, and he stifled tears. Of relief or of something deeper? He had been existing inside himself for so long now that he wasn't sure, but he righted himself immediately. He knew that if she got back to shore, she'd disappear into the rainforest. He did not like his odds of tracking her there. If she saw him clambering after her, though, and he didn't get a chance to confront her, she'd slip through his fingers and he'd never see her again. This, too, he knew. The tide had begun to come in. The light was dull and flat and gray. Again, the wind had become harsh, Out at sea, there was nothing to indicate human beings existed except for the rising and falling figure of the biologist, and a deep vein of black smoke opening up into the sky from some vessel so far out at sea that it wasn't visible even with the binoculars. He waited until she was more than halfway out, wondering if she'd lost some natural caution because it was still easier to cut her off than it should have been. Then he snuck along the other side of the ridge of rock, hunched over, trying to keep his silhouette off her horizon, although he'd be framed by forest, not the fading light. He had brought the knapsack with him out of paranoia that she or someone else might steal it while he was gone. Although he had stripped it down somewhat, it threw off his balance, made it harder to hold his gun and climb the rocks. He could have left Whitby's manuscript behind, but this had seemed more and more important to keep in view at all times. He tried to keep his steps short and to bend his knees, but even so slipped many times on the uneven rocks, slick with seaweed and rough and sharp from the edges of the shells of limpets and clams and mussels, had to reach out to keep his balance and cut himself despite the cloth he'd tied over his palms. Very soon his ankles and knees felt weak. By the time he was halfway out, the ridge of rocks had narrowed, and he had no choice but to clamber atop them. When he looked up from that vantage for the first time, the biologist was nowhere to be seen, which meant she had either found some miraculous way back to shore, or she was hidden somewhere ahead of him. No matter how he hunched and bent, she was going to have a clear line of sight at him. He didn't know what options she had. Rock? Knife? Homemade spear? If she wasn't glad to see him. He took off his hat, shoved it in the pocket of his raincoat, hoping that if she was watching, she would at least recognize that it was him, that this recognition might mean more to her than interrogator or captor, that it might make her hesitate should she be lying in wait. 3/4 of the way, and he wondered if he should just head back. His legs were rubbery, matching the feel of the rocks where the kelp swelled over them. The waves to either side struck with more force, and although he could still see now, the sun a lisp of red against the far horizon, illuminating the distant smoke. He'd have to use his flashlight going back, which would alert anyone on the shore to his presence. He hadn't come all this way just to betray her to others. So he continued on with a sense of fatalism. He'd sacrificed all his pawns, his knights, bishops, and rooks. Abuela and abuelo were facing an onslaught from the other side of the board. In the tiring, repetitious work of climbing on, of continuing on and not going back, a grim satisfaction spread in a last surge of energy through his body. He had pursued this line of inquiry to the end. He had come very far, this thought, mixed with sadness for what lay behind. So many people with whom he'd forged such slight connections. So many people that, as he neared the end of the rocks, he wished he had known better, tried to know better. His caring for his father now seemed not like a selfless effort, but something that had been for him, too, to show him what it meant to be close to someone. At the end of the ridge, he came upon a deep lagoon of ever-rippling, encircled water, roughly cradled by the rocks. Lagoon was perhaps too gentle a word for it, a gurgling deep hole whose sharp and irregular sides could cut hand or head easily. The bottom could not be seen. Beyond, just the endless ocean, frothing to get in, smashing against the closed fist of the rocks, so that spray flecked his face and the force of the wind buffeted him. But in the lagoon, all was calm, if unknowable in its dark reflection. She appeared so close from concealment on his left that he almost jumped back, caught himself in time by bending and putting out a hand. In that moment, he was helpless, and in steadying himself, he found that she had a gun trained on him. It looked like a Glock, like his own standard issue. He hadn't expected that. Somehow, somewhere, she had found a gun. She was thinner, her cheekbones as cutting as the rocks. Her hair had begun to grow out, a dark fuzz. She wore thick jeans and a sweater too big for her but heavy, and high-quality brown hiking boots. There was a defiance on her face that warred with curiosity and some other emotion. Her lips were chapped. In this, her natural environment, she seemed so sure of herself that he felt awkward, ungainly. Something had clicked into place, something had sharpened her, and he thought it might be memory. "Throw your gun into the sea," she said, motioning to his holster. She had to raise her voice for him to hear her, even this close. Close enough that with a few steps he could have reached out and touched her shoulder.
"We might need it later," he said.
"We?"
"Yes," he said. "More are coming. I've seen the lights." He did not want to share what had happened at the southern reach. Not yet. "Toss it now, unless you want to get shot." He believed her. He'd seen the reports from her training. She said she wasn't good with guns, but the targets hadn't agreed. So there went Grandpa, version 4.9, or 5.1, he hadn't kept track of the expeditions. The sea made it disappear with a smack that sounded like one last comment from Jack. John looked over at her, standing across from him while the waves blasted the rocks, and despite the gray, and despite the wet and the cold, despite the fact he might die sometime in the next few minutes, he started to laugh. It surprised him. Thought at first someone else was laughing. Her grip tightened on the gun. "Is the idea of me shooting you funny?"
"Yes," he said. "It's very, very funny."
He was laughing hard enough now that he had to bend to his knees to keep his balance on the rocks. A fierce joy, or hysteria, had risen inside of him, and he wondered in an idle, distant way if perhaps he should have sought out this feeling more often. The look of her, against the backdrop of the swell and the fall of the sea, was almost too much for him. But for the first time he knew he had done the right thing in coming here.
"It's funny, because there have been many other times, so many other times when I would have understood why someone wanted to shoot me."
That was only part of it. The other part being that he had felt almost as if Area X was about to shoot him, and that Area X had been trying to shoot him for a very long time. "You followed me," she said, "even though I clearly don't want to be followed. You've come to what most people consider the butt end of the world, and you've cornered me here. You probably want to ask more questions, although it should be clear that I'm done with questions. What did you think would happen?" The truth was, he didn't know what he had thought would happen. Had perhaps unconsciously fallen back on an idea of their relationship at the Southern Reach. But that didn't apply here. He sobered up, hands held high now, as if surrendering.
"What if I said I had answers?" he said,
but all he had to show her that was tangible was Whitby's manuscript. "I'd say you're lying, and I'd be right."
"What if I said you still hold some of the answers, too?"
He was as serious as he had been giddy just moments before. He tried to hold her with his gaze, even through the murk, but he couldn't. God, but the coast here was painfully beautiful, the dark, lush greens of the fir trees piercing his brain, the half-raging sky and sea, the surge of salt water against the rocks twinned to the urgent wash of blood through his arteries, as he waited for her to kill him or hear him out. Seditious thought. There would be nothing too terrible about dying out here, about becoming part of all this. "I'm not the biologist," she said. "I don't care about my past as the biologist, if that's what you mean."
"I know,"
he said. He'd figured it out on the boat, even if he hadn't articulated it yet.
"I know you're not. You're some version, though. You have her memories, to some extent, and somewhere back in Area X, the biologist may still be alive. You're a replica, but you're your own person.
Not an answer she had expected. She lowered the gun.
A little.
You believe me?
Yes. It had been right there, in front of him, in the video, in the very mimicry of cells, the difference in personality. Except she'd broken the mold. Something had been different in her creation.
I've been trying to remember this place, she said, almost plaintively. I love it here, but the entire time I felt like it was the one remembering me.
A silence that John didn't know if he wanted to break. So he just stood there.
Are you here to take me back? She said. Because I'm not going back.
No, I'm not, he said, and realized it was true. Whatever impulse in that regard that might have lived within him had been snuffed out. The Southern Reach doesn't exist anymore, he admitted. There may not be anything we'd recognize out there very soon.
There in the twilight, no birds now overhead, the smoke fading into the dusk, the raucous surf the only thing that seemed alive besides the two of them.
How did you know I'd be here? She asked, deep in thought. I was so careful.
I didn't. I guessed.
Somehow his face must have given something of his thoughts away, because she looked a little startled, a little wrong-footed.
Why would you do that if you don't want to take me back?
I don't know. To try to save the world? To save her? To save himself?
But he did know. Nothing had changed since the interrogation room, not really. When he looked up again, she was saying,
I thought I could just stay here, build the life she didn't build, that she messed up. But I can't. It's clear I can't. Someone will be after me no matter what I do.
Now that the sun had truly set, there was a glimmer of a light, dimly familiar to him, coming from deep in the lagoon below.
What's down there? He asked.
Nothing, said too quickly.
Nothing? It's too late to lie. There's no point.
It was never too late to lie, to obscure, to delay. Control knew this too well, but she didn't. She hesitated, then said,
I was sick when I got here. One night I came out here and I had a dizzy spell and I was unconscious for a while. I woke up with the tide rising and I wasn't sick anymore. The brightness was done with me. But there was something at the bottom of that hole.
What? Although he thought he already knew, the swirling light was too familiar, despite being broken by ripples and the thickness of the water.
It's a way into Area X, I think, she said, and now she looked scared. I think I brought it with me.
He didn't know how she knew this. He thought it might be true, remembered what Cheney had said about how difficult and enervating that travel could be, Whitby's horrible description of the border. Now that the darkness was complete, and she was just a shadow standing in front of him, they could both see the lights farther down the coast, bobbing, floating, trudging, dozens of them, and so far down below, that glimmer, that hint of an impossible light.
I don't think we have much longer, he said. I don't even know if we have the night. We'll have to find a place to hide.
Not wanting to think about the other possibility, not wanting even a hint of it in his thoughts to invade her thoughts.
It will be high tide soon, she said. You have to get off the rocks.
But not her? Even though he could not see her face, he knew the expression that must be etched there.
We both have to get off the rocks.
He wasn't sure he meant it. He could hear the helicopter now, could hear boats again, too, but if she was unhinged, if she was lying, if she didn't actually know anything at all. "I want to know who I am," she said. "I can't do that here. I can't do that locked up in a cell."
"I know who you are. It's all in my head, your file. I can give you that."
"I'm not going back," she said. "I'm never going back."
"It's dangerous," he told her, pleading as if she didn't know. "It's unproven. We don't know where you'll come out." The hole was so deep and so jagged, and the water beginning to churn from the waves. He had seen wonders, and he had seen terrible things. He had to believe that this was one more, and that it was true, and that it was knowable. Her stare took the measure of him. She was done talking. She threw her gun away. She dove into the water, down deep. He took one last look back at the world he knew. He took one huge gulp of it, every bit of it he could see, every bit of it he could remember. "Jump," said a voice in his head. Control jumped. This concludes the reading of Authority by Jeff Vandermeer, copyright 2014 by Vandermeer Creative, Inc. This book was read by Bronson Pinchot. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Farrar, Straus & Giroux, LLC, and was produced in 2014 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.